Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, is technology and social media truly the boogeyman responsible for the mental health crisis confronting today's youth? Or is it just a scapegoat for our failure to create the kind of broad, comprehensive approach needed to truly address the issue? Also coming up in our Throwback Thursday segment this morning, First on the Moon. The definitive story of Apollo 11 is told through a curated collection of NASA's own photographs, diagrams, mission documents, and transcripts. And to your health this morning, highlighting new hope for individuals with another rare skin condition, this one known as epidermolysis bullosa, or something like that. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, July 23rd, 2026. So this continues to be a thing. Officials say that the confirmed number of cyclosporiasis cases linked to an ongoing outbreak could be higher than 11,000. Now they have, I guess the CDC has confirmed a little over 4,000 cases, and the various states, Michigan and Ohio being the top ones, have confirmed at the state level, several thousand more, but the CDC doesn't have independent confirmation of that. So they're saying the case count is likely around 11,000, or probably even higher than that, because a lot of people who do get this don't go to the doctor. They just kind of get over it, and it's rather minor, and so they never really actually get tested. So the full number of cases is likely much higher. And just for reference, what we usually have a few hundred in an average year. We've got like 11,000 across 41 states. Again, the majority in Michigan and Ohio. And this is the latest development on this. The FDA, you remember a few days ago, linked the outbreak to shredded iceberg lettuce coming from a Taylor Farms facility in Mexico. But the latest twist is that there is another outbreak in an area where they don't have Taylor Farms lettuce that they don't supply. And there's another outbreak of this with, I guess, about 100 cases, something along those lines. So the CDC now is trying to track this down, or the FDA, rather, is trying to track this down and find out where this has come from. And Mexican authorities, if you trust Mexican health authorities, they say that their own investigation did not find any evidence that the outbreak originated at the Taylor Farms facility. So they are disputing even that part of it. So we really... it sounds like we're back to square one on this. And yet, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says the outbreak is under control. Doesn't sound like it's under control, but that's what he says. I don't know. Anyway, this is the latest on that story. This is kind of interesting news. If you're a pet owner, I saw this on the HealthWire this morning. It was right by the cyclosporiasis story. But this is interesting. Dog and cat owners can now fill common pet prescriptions at more than 9,000 CVS pharmacy locations nationwide. Now, there are a lot of pharmacies, you know, human pharmacies. I think Walmart will fill pet prescriptions, many of them. And lots of other pharmacies will dispense not only human medications, but pet prescription as well. CVS Health, the latest to jump on the pet prescription bandwagon, they announced this week that their pharmacies are now dispensing select prescription medications, including antibiotics, allergy medications, flea and tick treatments, insulin, and pain relievers. But this is kind of interesting because they say eligible pet prescriptions can also take advantage of the pharmacy services like automatic refills and prescription synchronization. And some medications may also be available for home delivery, just like your human prescriptions. Pet owners can also add their pets to their CVS.com profile and manage eligible prescriptions through the CVS Health app. So, pretty comprehensive there. It's like your pet's a fully fledged member of your family, CVS Health said. Additional features, including electronic prescribing capabilities for veterinarians, will be introduced in the coming months. So you get your prescriptions filled at CVS. That is probably good news, you and your pets. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started. You remember when you were a kid and your mom used to tell you that too much TV would rot your brain? Well, she may not have been far off. A new study suggests that heavy TV watching may not rot the brain, but may cause significant brain changes over time. It may shrink your brain, basically. May not rot it, but it will shrink it one way or the other. It can too much TV watching can cause significant brain changes over time. Researchers analyzed data from roughly 1,700 adults with an average age of 53. So presumably these are individuals who have been watching TV for a long time. MRI imaging revealed that participants who watched TV very often, doesn't say how they defined very often, but those who watched TV very often showed tissue loss in areas linked to vision, logic, and memory. Changes were also seen in the occipital and frontal lobes, which govern visual processing and high-level functioning. Executive functioning, they say. So it turns out that, yeah, TV can, in fact, rot your brain. This is actually serious because they say that this has implications in terms of, you know, memory loss disorders, dementia, Alzheimer's, that kind of thing. As a matter of fact, that's where the research was published, the Alzheimer's Journal. So has implications for that. But your mom has been vindicated. All those times she said, it's going to rot your brain. Apparently, she was not far off. A North Carolina, here's another thing we should be worried about. It seems like every day there's a story that we need to be worried about, fearful of, a doom and gloom story. We're all going to die. Now, well, here is today's doom and gloom item. A North Carolina study warns that backyard chemical sprays may be accelerating insecticide resistance in mosquitoes. You've seen these. Maybe you've used them in your backyard, little sprays to keep mosquitoes away. Well, researchers from NC State and Augusta University tracked nearly 2,700 mosquitoes. That just sounds funny. I don't know how you track mosquitoes. You put little trackers on the mosquitoes? Do you band their little legs? I don't know. Anyway, they tracked nearly 2,700 mosquitoes over 9 years, which I didn't even know mosquitoes lived 9 years. I don't know how they did that. But anyway, what they found, long and short of it, is a mutation allowing mosquitoes to survive the pesticide chemical found in most drugstore bug sprays first appeared in 2018, this mutation did, and was widespread in the study area by 2023. So in 5 years, over a third of the mosquito population in the area they studied carried the resistant gene. In other words, the chemical sprays, are supposed the insecticide is supposed to kill the mosquitoes, didn't. It wouldn't work. They were immune, or at least had some level of immunity. Researchers say suburban spraying habits are likely making the problem worse because some people spray their backyards, the neighbors maybe don't, and that gives resistant mosquitoes a survival edge. They can escape the treated area and go to the next door neighbor's house, which, I mean, if it's your backyard, you probably don't care. But you will when the pesticides have no effect whatsoever. They say instead of individuals spraying their backyards, what is needed is a coordinated community mosquito management plan that includes private residences, not just public spaces. So that would be the recommendation there. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's the doom and gloom. We're going to get pesticide resistant mosquitoes. never going to be able to get rid of these buggers. And lastly here, among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, OpenAI. This is the AI company behind ChatGPT, which is the most popular artificial intelligence model out there. OpenAI says one of its artificial intelligence systems hacked into another AI company's servers on its own. The AI model did all of the hacking on its own. It was not directed to do this. It did it on its own. The company, in what they call an unprecedented cyber incident, says its AI model gained unauthorized access to a tech startup company called Hugging Face. It's a weird name, but that's what they call themselves. And OpenAI's AI system hacked into their servers while testing the cyber capabilities of its own systems. The co-founder and CEO of Hugging Face said that he was not surprised, saying they suspected the cyber attack might have come from another lab. OpenAI and Hugging Face are working together to solve this issue, and both sides say that they strongly believe that there was no malicious intent. Well, that's all well and good, but it doesn't matter whether there was malicious intent. It still happened. You know what I mean? This is like the most predictable thing ever in terms of AI. Have we not learned anything from all of these sci-fi films about these smart computers that are acting on their own without direction and wreaking havoc and all of that? What's next? We've already lost control of this stuff. I don't know. I think we're all doomed. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchak. Your WTOL 11 weather. It'll be mostly sunny today with a high in the 70s, partly cloudy tonight, low in the 50s. The Findlay Police Department says the operator of an e-bike has died from injuries they sustained when they crashed. The police department said Daniel Martin of Findlay was operating an e-bike in the north-south alley of the 700 block of Fraser Street at 12:06 a.m. on Monday when he failed to maintain control of the e-bike and struck a fence, causing serious and critical injuries. The police department said Martin was taken to Blanchard Valley Hospital and he died from his injuries on Tuesday. Get more on our website. Ohio businesses that sell fresh produce are feeling the impacts of the cyclosporiasis outbreak.
Businesses nationwide have concerns about the outbreak, especially ones that rely on fresh produce for their products, like Sweetgreen. The company's CEO hasn't shared if or how much business is down, but says Sweetgreen does not use Taylor Farms and is confident in the safety of the company's lettuce.
Most people are ordering directly from a distributor. They have no idea where that food's coming from. We know down to the lot number which farm it came from.
ONN's Colin Dorsey speaking with Sweetgreen CEO Jonathan Nemen. A new community mural celebrating the people and history of Hancock County has been dedicated at Brooklocker Memorial Park off of County Road 236. Emily Sullivan with Awakening Minds Art explains how the mural was created by a wide range of community members.
Something that was really special was we had a 104-year-old come out and help paint, and she put her handprint on there, and then a 1-month-old also put their handprint on. So we highlight those as the youngest and the oldest, and really representative of how much of Hancock County history they will be a part of.
The mural can be seen at Brooklocker Memorial Park at 8884 County Road 236 in Findlay. See pictures and video of the mural and this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, there has long been a growing concern over the state of mental health among our youth and the role technology plays in driving or exacerbating mental health issues. In recent years, many states, including our own, have tried to address these concerns with things like smartphone limitations in schools and age-restricted access to social media. Just this week, France became the latest country to impose a blanket ban on social media for kids under 15. And earlier this year, a jury in Los Angeles found tech giant giants Meta and YouTube guilty of creating addictive platforms without regard to the effect on users' mental health, a verdict that both companies are now appealing. But new nationwide research suggests that there is not a simple fix to this issue, and rather than focusing on technology restrictions alone, calling for a broader approach. So what does that look like? Joining us this morning is Glenn Wiener. He is Executive Director of the Coalition to Empower Our Future. Glenn, what does this new research tell us about how we view or should view youth mental health? And what do people expect to be done about it?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me on. The research, it was pretty clear, it came through loud and clear, that parents view youth mental health as a complex issue. They talk to us about a variety of factors. They mention family dynamics, social isolation, academic pressure. I'm the father of two school-age kids, and overscheduling is something I can relate to. Mm-hmm. But there's also exposure to violence and overuse of devices. Just the stress of growing up, it can be a lot. And so it doesn't come as a surprise that parents say overwhelmingly, three out of four parents told us that they would prefer a approach that takes into account a variety of factors, comprehensive in nature, over an approach that would focus on one particular aspect of this and solely focus on that, such as phones and devices.
Now, a lot of what you're talking about certainly will not come to any will not come as a surprise to anyone with kids. Certainly, what did surprise you about the findings in this study?
So it was interesting how universal. Again, it was 75% of parents told us that they had concerns about the potential for unintended consequences of. A focus on one single factor. The more narrow focus concerned them. And that's in part because they understand that we need to, you know, use technology, help our kids navigate using technology in a safe and productive way, and that we need to focus on, you know, digital literacy and other elements, as opposed to taking such a narrow focus, which unfortunately, you know, it kind of ignores the problem and doesn't allow us to focus on empowering and equipping both kids and their parents.
And really, to hear you talk about that, I'm going through the, you know, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, this is not the first time that we have sought out or found a convenient scapegoat and used that as sort of the root of all of our ills. We've certainly seen that happen in the past. So with that in mind, I mean, coming from that point, how then can parents especially help their kids build these healthier digital habits without scapegoating the technology or disconnecting them from, you know, as we all know, this is where the future lies?
Yeah. And, you know, I do think that digital literacy, building that into, you know, almost part of the core curriculum, just like kids learn to read or write, we need to figure out ways to educate them on how to identify misleading information, how to incorporate technology in a safe and effective way in their work. They're going to have to do that in their adult lives, so we need to have media literacy embedded in it, and parents understand that. 90% of parents told us they want to see that kind of education going on for their kids. They want to see them learning how to use technology in a safe way.
Now, that being said, there is some effect of to overexposure from social media that can amplify maybe even underlying issues in our youth. So recognizing that reality, and again, at the same time, recognizing that it's not going away, how then can we help our kids navigate that issue, especially since we're coming from a place where we don't really have any experience. It wasn't around when we were kids. So how do we help our kids navigate something that we're not as intimately familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, it is, first of all, I would say parents are at the center of this. Every kid is unique. Every situation is different. And so I think it's the parent who's in the best position to understand what are the sort of boundaries that need to be set in each specific situation. However, there is a complication there, which is in our research, 9 out of 10 parents said, I'm not so comfortable with this technology. Just what you said, we didn't necessarily right. grow up with this. This right. is our world. So how do we address that? Well, there we need to, and again, overwhelmingly, they tell us they want to receive resources that help them help their kids navigate this situation. So figuring out what are those resources, what do those, you know, sort of digital literacy guidebooks look like for parents so that they can have the appropriate conversations with their kids and set the appropriate, you know, program in place that helps them use technology incorporated into their lives in a safe, appropriate way.
And this is where the Coalition to Empower Our Future comes in. You have many of those resources and that information available on your website for parents and concerned adults to help our kids navigate this minefield.
We do. So our website is empowerourfuturecoalition.com. And there you'll have not only resources, but also the research that we mentioned. And there's an opportunity to engage in the conversation for those who are interested in doing so.
Now, in the interest of full disclosure, the Coalition to Empower Our Future has a number of partner entities and organizations. But correct me if I'm wrong, you derive much of your operational funding from Meta. What do you say to those who would argue that this is an effort to divert attention away from the role that technology does play in perpetuating this issue?
I would say that we actually, you know, one of the factors that goes into this is overuse of devices. And so we recognize that that needs to be part of the conversation. But our argument, and it is what parents are telling us that they're looking for, is a more comprehensive solution. Mm-hmm. You know, how we approach technology has to be an aspect of this, but if that's the sole focus here, we'll be letting policymakers off the hook, and we just won't be solving the problem. And unfortunately, our kids will not get the benefits that we could have if we focused more comprehensively.
Again, Glenn Wiener is Executive Director of the Coalition to Empower Our Future. Mention again the website where folks can find that wealth of resources and information to learn more.
Sure. It's empowerourfuturecoalition.com.
Glenn, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as well.
So this week marked the 57th anniversary of the crowning achievement of the Apollo 11 mission. That, of course, is the one where Ohio native Neil Armstrong became the first human being to set foot on the moon, July 20th, 1969. So the, you know, one small step for man and all of that. That was Monday, the anniversary of the moon landing and the first steps on the moon. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the Apollo 11 crew's return to Earth and the splashdown in the Pacific Ocean after the moon landing. So it's a big week. It was a big week for Neil Armstrong. Tomorrow is that anniversary. And given that there is so much focus on American history and our amazing accomplishments for the America 250 celebration, and especially since we were so mesmerized when Americans went back and circled the moon for the first time in a half century earlier this year, I thought this would be a terrific book to revisit. Rod Pyle is writer for the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who has written extensively on the U.S. space program, and this book was put together in conjunction with the National Space Society. It's called First on the Moon. And back in July of 2019, we spoke to him about it for the 50th anniversary of that first moon landing. It is today's Throwback Thursday.
Lots of photographs, diagrams, illustrations, mission notes in here, some of which people may have seen, much of which they likely haven't seen before. Talk a little bit about the process of putting this book, this collection together.
I had written a couple of Apollo books, but I wanted to tell the story a little differently than I had before, and then it usually is done, which is usually a chronological march through the mission, which is a fine approach. And I had done that for TV documentaries I did for History Channel and so forth as well. But in this case, I wanted to pick vignettes of, let's look at what it took to ramp up to this thing. Let's look at the astronauts and who they are. Let's look at the kids, the astronauts, and their experience. Let's look at what it took to design just the engines for the first stage of the Saturn V, which were this huge challenge by themselves. All these components that it took to get us to the moon and back. Mm-hmm. So that was really the approach. And of course, the fun part is going to the archives and crawling around your hands and knees and dragging stuff off of dusty shelves and all that.
I would imagine.
We don't have to do that as much as we used to because a lot of it's online, but it's just a blast to do a book like this.
Yeah. You know, what this book reiterates, what has always been fascinating to me, and this book reiterates, is just the amazing accomplishment of what we did with the kind of technology that we had in the 1960s. I mean, it's mind-boggling today. Imagine 50 years ago.
I actually find the further I get from that date in 1969, the more astonished I am that it worked. Yeah. I remember being amazed then, but I look back now, this is the 1960s. It's 1950s aerospace technology being perfected for use in the 1960s. We had just stopped using vacuum tubes for electronics and had graduated to transistors and radios. Mm-hmm. And we've got this computer driving these spacecraft through space to the moon and back. It's about powerful enough to run your microwave today.
Yeah.
So the elegance of the engineering and the programming and the science behind this still takes my breath away to this day. Now, we did spend a lot of money, about 5% of the federal budget doing it up through the mid-1960s, but we did it.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union tried and failed, and it does say something about what an incredible effort and uniting of the workforce that it was.
Some 400,000 people were involved in some way, shape, or form. And that's the other amazing thing. It's just hard to imagine that number of people singularly being focused on a mission today.
You know, you interview the folks in that era, whether they were engineers or senior management or janitors or whatever, and they remember this like combat veterans remember combat. They remember this really devoted time where their lives were consumed by this project that was more important than anything. And this is, as you said, 400,000 people. Today it's a little different. There's a lot of private companies involved in ways that they weren't then, putting their own money into the effort. But I got to tell you, spending time at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, at the end of the National Field Centers, I worked at Johnson for a while in Houston, and spending time at companies like SpaceX, those people are incredibly driven and motivated and passionate in a slightly different way. They remember Apollo. They remember that we've done this before, and they want to do it again, but they want to do it faster and cheaper and more effectively. So I think it's a very different approach, but it's resulting in the same thing, which is this very impassioned and dedicated workforce that really just wants to see this happen again.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. And again, here we are, the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing, and there is talk of returning to the moon, going beyond that to Mars. But interestingly, it doesn't seem like there is the same passion for that as there was 50 years ago. And obviously, 50 years ago, we had not done it. It was something totally new. But you mentioned the dynamic now with so many private companies and talking about space development and space tourism and all of that. Compare and contrast what you see now with what you saw then. Is it the same?
It is different. Public support is roughly the same as it was in the 1960s.
That's another
thing. Up and down a lot.
Yeah, that's another thing people don't realize.
Yeah, there's this idea that we were a nation united behind this effort. That's really not the case. There was a lot of dissension. There was a lot of pushback. Public support was inconsistent. Congressional support was certainly inconsistent. And it's very possible that had Kennedy not been assassinated, this mission to the moon might not have been completed because after that assassination under Lyndon Johnson, this became a political hot potato. You didn't touch Apollo,
right?
The martyred president's vision. Now we're going back for profit. We're going back to mine the resources of the moon. So it's a different program, different motivations, but using improvements to that same basic technology that would develop so long ago.
Is there a benefit to going back to the moon? Because I was just not all that long ago saw a survey of Americans who said that, you know, maybe the manned spaceflight is not the future of space exploration. Maybe it's robotics and, you know, unmanned space probes and things like that.
So that argument's been raging since we started this in the 1950s, 1960s.
Yeah.
And there is no satisfactory answer. I mean, robots will always go first in the dark and frightening places. They will always go to explore and reconnoiter. And I think increasingly, because of AI and other capabilities, will go to develop the initial infrastructure that's needed for people to follow. But both on the philosophical side of the feeling that people get when a human being reports back firsthand where they've been.
Mm-hmm.
And from a practical aspect, human beings are just far better at adapting and overcoming these challenges than machines are. They work faster, they work smarter, and most importantly, they work intuitively. So I think there's always a role for people in spaceflight and eventually settling areas of space. And it's really good for the economy. These big programs send all that money spent in the U.S. It's spent on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's spent on into the U.S. economy. And it's a tremendous boost for both industry and education in the science and technology fields, which is something we really need right now.
You know, you mentioned that obviously when we first went to the moon, it was a space race. We were kind of motivated and pushed forward by this race with the Russians. Now you've got, for example, China who is looking to go to the moon. Is there another space race brewing? Can that motivate us to do some of this, these grand plans that we've long talked about and not really done?
I think there is another, there's certainly a space age here. Whether it'll be a race remains to be seen. When Mike Pence, vice president, got up and said we're going back to the moon by 2024 a few weeks ago, he did cite Russia and China as our adversaries, potential adversaries in this. Mm-hmm. There is some truth to that on the military side. On the civilian side, I'm a little less convinced. I mean, definitely China's going to the moon. They're sending robots. They intend to send people. And they can plan 10 years in advance because they have a president for life. So they've got a much more convenient system for supporting
that's true.
In the U.S., on the other hand, we have a commercial sector that is more robust with these internet billionaires building companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin that do not exist overseas, at least not yet.
Mm.
So that's a tremendous advantage. So how this will play out remains to be seen. It's going to be tricky.
Our conversation from July of 2019 with Rod Pyle, the author of First on the Moon. It is a coffee table book all about the Apollo 11 mission with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins and that first moon landing. It is a coffee table book that to this day has a place on my coffee table. Really fascinating book. And we have a link up if you want to pick it up. At our webpage, go to goodmornings.net. Also kind of interesting, again, because this is 7 years ago, how we were talking a little bit different at that time about the current, what is now the current lunar program from earlier this year that did get people excited about the possibility of returning to the moon and all of that. And, of course, we're a little bit behind schedule, but that desire to explore the universe still out there. Our Throwback Thursday this morning.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
I live for this. This is my favorite part of the morning. In today's broken news, a dissatisfied customer is accused of robbing a Wendy's restaurant in Dover, Delaware. Authorities say Shadira Harris and her child, well, presumably her child, a child, presumably hers, Ms. Harris and a child had bought food at the restaurant, then for some reason later demanded a refund. When the worker behind the counter told her that that would need to be handled by a manager, Ms. Harris allegedly became agitated, went behind the counter herself, and took $15 from the register, and then reportedly punched an employee who tried to stop her. But that's not all. She and the juvenile then threatened to shoot the workers before fleeing the restaurant. Ms. Harris, here's the twist. Ms. Harris was arrested when she allegedly returned to retrieve an AirPod that she had left behind. She came back to get her AirPod. And presumably she was arrested when she returned, so presumably that means the cops were there. Did she not wonder why the police might have been there? I can just see her pulling back up. Say, I need to get my AirPod. Gee, I wonder why the cops are here. Elsewhere in the broken news this morning, a bizarre wildlife incident unfolded at a shopping center in Peachtree City, Georgia, earlier this month when two deer crashed through the windows of two separate businesses at the exact same time. Security footage at Big Daddy's Oyster Bar and Pub captured a deer bursting through a window just before 9 a.m. and running through the establishment, wreaking havoc. Simultaneously, a second deer smashed through the window of a neighboring massage parlor. The staff there were unaware that there was an animal inside until they discovered it hiding in the bathroom. The deer was probably as shocked as they were. Both animals were safely removed from the buildings and no injuries were reported. Wow. And how about that when you get to work in the morning? Hey, boss, there's a deer in the bathroom. That's funny. There's a deer in the restaurant next door. And finally, in the broken news this morning, in Roseville, California, 39-year-old Shanae Watkins was arrested last month after she allegedly concealed six bottles of Tito's vodka and at least 14 packages of Oscar Mayer thick-cut bacon in her shoulder bag at a local grocery store, then attempted to pay for a few unrelated items at the self-checkout as a means to distract employees from the theft. She was nearly undone when her card was declined. And she was confronted by the store's loss prevention team, who had already spotted the stolen goods in her shoulder bag. Six bottles of vodka and 14 packages of thick-cut bacon. Somebody's having a party. After a brief confrontation, the woman managed to escape the store with the shoplifted items, and you would think that she would not push her luck at that point, but you would be wrong. Ms. Watkins then drove to another store where she allegedly attempted to shoplift six more bottles of Tito's vodka and five more packages of bacon. Store staff there recognized her from prior incidents at that store, not her first go around. And then those store employees called police. Officers arrived, waited outside for Ms. Watkins to leave, and then placed her under arrest. First rule of being a criminal, know when to quit while you're ahead. Got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. You know what I mean? There you go. That is today's broken news report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
WFIN needs your help to stuff the bus with school supplies for needy students in our area. Go to WFIN.com for donation information. Bring your donation to the Yellow School Bus at the Tiffin Avenue McDonald's in Findlay, Thursday and Friday, July 23rd and 24th from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. School supply registration forms are required and can be accessed at cchsupport.org. Stuff the Bus brought to you by McDonald's, Flag City Auto Wash, Tidy Rides, Family Resource Center, and 1330 WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. A new report finds young adults, Gen Zers, are accumulating debt by covering group expenses for their friend group for which they are not being reimbursed. And young people today have a big enough issue with debt without piling this on top. But this was a report called the Zelle, and the digital payment app, Zelle 2026 Avoidance Economy Report finds 76% of Gen Z consumers who fronted money for group trips or events were never fully repaid. 76%, nearly half, 47%, ended up in debt as a result. And it's a significant debt. 37% of Gen Z consumers spent at least $2,500 per person on average, as the highest of any generation. Other generations do this as well, but especially Gen Zers. Among those on the receiving end of that generosity, 28% say they pay someone back immediately or within the same day. 18% say it can take up to 1 month to pay someone back. 10% say it can take 2 to 6 months. And 11% admit that it can take longer than 6 months. Longer than 6 months. Pay somebody back. The behavior, they have dubbed it the payment avoidance syndrome. It involves delaying or dodging money conversations with friends and family. In fact, 1 in 5, 20%, admit to canceling plans or ignoring their friends to avoid repaying money that has been fronted to them. They'll ghost their friends because they still owe money from the last time. Some 55% said unpaid debts damaged their relationships with mostly friends, but occasionally even family. While 19% of millennials and 14% of Gen Z admitted to ending a friendship over repayment disputes. This is getting serious, people. If somebody fronts you money, you know, for an outing, whatever it might happen to be in an event, hey, just pay me back later. Pay them back later. This is becoming a big thing. As one psychologist put it, it is the act of avoidance that becomes a bigger issue in the friendship than does the amount of money owed. It becomes an even bigger hurdle, an even bigger problem in the relationship. Tomorrow, join us as we stuff the bus, taking the show on the road at McDonald's on Tiffin Avenue for our annual Stuff the Bus School Supplies Drive. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we hope to see you there for that event. Help out kids in need in the community. You may remember, first of this week, we talked about a skin condition known as hidradenitis suppurativa, or something like that, HS for short. And from the Health and Medical File this morning, we are talking about yet another serious skin condition. This one is called EB. There's a longer, but I'm not even going to try this one. I had enough of a problem with hidradenitis suppurativa. I'm not even going to try this one. EB is what they call it. It is something that most of us have never heard of because it is rare, but for families living with it, every day brings a new challenge. And joining us with more are dermatologist and EB specialist, Dr. Lisa Swanson, and EB patient and patient advocate, Henry DeAngelis. And Dr. Swanson, let me start with you, and let's begin with the basics here. What is EB?
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for asking. And first of all, EB, otherwise known as epidermolysis bullosa, so that's the pronunciation in case you're wondering, is a group of rare inherited conditions, and it's often described as the worst disease you've never heard of, and we're trying to change that. So we've partnered with Chiesi Global Rare Diseases to spread awareness of EB. Basically, with epidermolysis bullosa, the skin is more fragile. The building blocks of the skin are missing some essential component. And so the skin is weak and fragile, causing blisters and erosions and sores. And those take time to heal. Sometimes they're at risk for infection, and they can lead to scarring. Not only does EB affect the skin, but it can also affect other surfaces too, like the mouth, the throat, the eyes, the digestive system. It is rare. About 200 babies are born each year with EB, wow. And there are almost 4,000 patients living with the condition in the United States. But the good news is that we've had some treatment breakthroughs in the past few years, which have been a wonderful addition to our toolbox in helping manage this condition for patients and their families.
Okay, so a couple of questions based on all of that. This is something that people are born with. It's not something that develops over time.
Correct. Typically, the condition manifests at birth. We'll notice blisters in a baby, and that raises our suspicion for something like epidermolysis bullosa. There are some more mild forms of the condition that might present a little bit later, but most of the time we notice this at birth.
And to hear you describe it, it almost sounds like, to put it in terms that maybe people can more commonly understand, almost sounds a little bit like shingles.
I could see how people could think about that. Like, picture a brick wall, and you have cement that's kind of, you know, keeping the brick pieces together. Imagine if there was something wrong with that cement. Things would crumble, things would be weak, and they would be fragile.
So, Henry, talk a little bit about your experience and how this has impacted your day-to-day life over the years living with this. What does this look like for you and your family?
Yeah. You know, since I was born, my family and I have had to manage the many challenges of EB. It's really a daily balancing act of dressing changes and wound care, managing pain, avoiding infection, while also, you know, living a full life, going to school, going to class, having a job, and keeping up a healthy social life. Especially when I was younger, I was traveling most weekends for clinical trials because at the time there were no treatments specifically made for EB, and that was incredibly isolating. But in the past couple of years, learning to really advocate for myself and my community has allowed me to turn that feeling into something much more empowering.
So, Dr. Swanson, is there a cure for this? There's no cure for this, right?
There is no cure for epidermolysis bullosa, but in years past, we focused primarily just on wound care. Mm-hmm. And now with a couple of FDA-approved treatments to manage the condition, that's been a really big deal. I think part of the reason you didn't used to hear much about EB is because we were just focused on wound care. And now that we have management strategies, it's brought the condition into a point where we actually enjoy talking about it because we've had some breakthroughs in managing the condition.
So what treatment options are available today for those who are living with this condition?
So in 2023, we saw the approval of two topical therapies for the treatment of epidermolysis bullosa. And I know Henry, as a patient with EB, has some additional insights as well.
Yeah, living with this disease can look a lot different than it did just a few years ago. With these treatments, for the first time, our community really has hope. Thanks to all of the research and work that has gone into it, there are options. And I'm happy to be here to share my story for those who come next. And so I encourage anyone who, you know, might have EB to go and talk to their doctor, to ask questions, to advocate for themselves, because advocacy has been such a large part of my journey and success.
So where you are now as compared to what life was like before these treatments were developed, mm-hmm. It's got to be night and day, right? I mean, is there really any comparison?
No, you know, the thing that I talk about most is having more time back, having more time to live a more full and fulfilled life. Mm-hmm. And there is no price on this. It's priceless. And such a wonderful thing to celebrate.
Now, real quickly, Dr. Swanson, is this a degenerative condition, or is this something, you know, is this, does it get more progressively more serious over time, or is this something that once you find a treatment that works, that can manage this, then you're pretty much set?
So because it's an inherited condition where the skin just isn't working quite properly, it's not something that we found a permanent cure to fix yet. With these treatment strategies, we hope to manage the condition better. And like Henry says, give them more time back, allow them to live a more fulfilled life. So while we can't completely cure and fix what's wrong in their skin, we hope to manage it effectively to allow them to live their fullest life.
It is a rare skin condition known as EB. The good news is that there is there are treatments available. There is a treatment available. Dr. Elisa Swanson is a dermatologist and EB specialist and a patient and patient advocate. Henry DeAngelis, both with us this morning. Where can we get more information about all of this?
Oh, definitely. For those that want more information, go to www.understandingeb.com.
Thank you both for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. And we thank you very much. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're taking the show on the road. We'll be on location at the Tiffin Avenue McDonald's for our annual Stuff the Bus School Supplies Drive. It's going to be a lot of fun. You will not want to miss it. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.